Chapter 1. 4 pages, 5 computers, and the hay mound. I was born on December 16, 1964, in Nashua, Iowa, to Robert and Donna Wadelick. Nashua is a town small enough that the question of where you came from has only ever had a few answers, and most of them connect eventually to a farm. In my case, the farm sat 2 miles north of the Nashua Fairgrounds, and it belonged to my grandparents, Don and Marion Zwanziger. I spent the better part of my boyhood there with my 2 cousins, Mark and Philip. For any 10-year-old boy in the early 1970s, that farm was a kingdom. The barn was a fortress. The hay mound was a mountain you could fall off without dying. The fields ran out past where your eye could see them. We were small in a place that was large, and we knew it, and we loved it. I knew my great-grandmother Jessie before she died, but I cannot honestly say I knew her well. She was Jessie Richards Shadbolt, my grandmother Marion's mother. She had 8 children of her own, 2 of whom were Marion and her sister Joycey. By the time I met her, she was living in a nursing home in Shell Rock, 40 miles down the road. The visits were rare, and the woman I saw on those visits had already been worn down by illness. She did not speak very much. The family told me she had been a joyous person once. I had to take their word for it. The Jessie I knew was a quiet old woman whose body had outlasted whatever it was that had made her joyful. She died in 1972. I was 8. 3 Decembers later, Christmas vacation of 1975, I was back at the farm. School was out. My cousins were home. Mark and Philip and I were in my grandfather's hay mound that afternoon, building forts out of bales the way every farm boy who has ever been in a hay mound has built forts out of bales. The hay scratched. The air was cold above the bales and warm down inside them. Mark's birthday falls on December 31st, which meant that for the 2 weeks every year between his birthday and ours, we were all the same age. That fortnight was our season. We were 10 years old together, lost in the work of small empires. My grandmother Marion and her sister Joycey had spent that day at Jessie's house in Shell Rock. Jessie had been gone about 3 years by then. Her things had been sitting in her attic the whole time, waiting. Marion and Joycey had gone over to begin the work of going through them. That evening, they came back to the farm. They called us in from the hay mound. Mark, Philip, and I climbed down out of the bales and came into the kitchen. They had 2 boxes with them and a uniform. The boxes held letters. The letters had been written by a man named Edward Bennett, who was my great-great-great-grandfather. He had served 2 years in the Union Army during the Civil War. The uniform was the one he had worn. My grandmother held that uniform up against my 10-year-old body. I remember her doing it. I remember the room. I remember how the uniform looked, hanging there in her hands, faded but still recognizable as what it had been 110 years before. I have to say, it might have fit. A boy who knew where that uniform was from. If you grew up in the American Midwest in the 1970s, you got a steady indoctrination in the Civil War. It was in the textbooks, in the bicentennial mood, in the television. I was always proud of being from the Union States and what they stood for, the way every boy on every farm between Iowa and Ohio was proud of the same thing. It was a settled fact, like the weather. So when my grandmother held that uniform up against me, I did not need to be told what I was looking at. I did not know who had worn it, but I knew exactly where it was from. A year before, there had been a made-for-TV movie of The Red Badge of Courage starring Richard Thomas, who at the time was John Boy on The Waltons. Half the 10-year-olds in the country knew him by sight. In that film, he wore a uniform like the one in my grandmother's hands. I had watched it. The cut, the color, the brass. I knew the whole shape of the thing from television before I ever stood next to the real article in my grandparents' kitchen. Less interesting to me at that moment, but heavier in the long run, was the box of letters that came with the uniform. The letters had been written by Edward Bennett to his wife, Janet Hume Bennett. I did not know who he was. We did not have the resources in 1975 to research the kind of question I would have needed to ask. I'm not sure my grandmother knew much beyond that she was related to him somehow. He was a name on a faded sheet of paper and a uniform that almost fit. That was the whole introduction. But I wanted those letters. Like every boy growing up at that moment in American memory, I was already fascinated by the Civil War. The idea that someone in my family had fought in it was, in the literal sense, unbelievable. It belonged to other people on the other side of the screen, and here it was on my grandmother's kitchen table. What I could not read, the originals did not stay with my grandmother. They were distributed among Jesse's 8 children, one to a family, the way letters and pictures and small heirlooms scatter when a person dies. Today I only know the whereabouts of one of those original letters. The rest have gone where things go when nobody is left to ask after them. But I had not let them go. I asked my grandmother Marion to take me to the library in Nashua, and there I made photocopies of every letter she had access to before they left her house. Those copies traveled with me the rest of my life. From one move to the next, one decade to the next, one box to the next, they were my version of the letters, inferior to the originals on paper, more permanent, in fact, because I never lost them. I began to try to read them. They were hard. People in the mid-1800s spoke in a different form of English than what came out of a 1970s television set. Their grammar was more formal. Their vocabulary leaned on words and phrases I would have to grow up before I could meet again. Edward's handwriting was beautiful, but it was script. Tight, slanted, period correct, and largely impenetrable to a 10-year-old boy. I worked at them off and on for years. I would pull them out, try a page, get a sentence or two, lose the next paragraph entirely, and put them back. I cannot honestly say that any of those attempts ever delivered me a complete reading. I would catch a word like march or camp and feel a flicker of the man underneath. Then the script would close around the rest of the sentence and the flicker would go. As technology improved, I scanned my photocopies and made digital copies of the copies. That felt like progress. I had something I could open on a screen, zoom in on, compare against another page. For a while, the letters traveled with me in folders from computer to computer. And then, as it goes with anything carried from machine to machine across decades, I lost most of them. The digital copies got left behind in upgrades. The photocopies I had carried from boyhood stayed mostly in a box somewhere. But most of my digitization was gone. What I still have, what survived every transfer, is 4 pages. 4 pages are the last things I know for certain of my great-great-great-grandfather, Edward Bennett. I have never forgotten them. Every few years, I pull them out and try again to read what is there. And every time my mind drifts past the paper and into whatever it was he saw. A day in the rain. In May of 2018, I went to Louisiana to walk one of his battlefields. The Battle of Mansfield, also called Sabine Crossroads, was fought on April 8, 1864, on a single road through Pine Forest, 40 miles south of Shreveport. It was the worst day of the Red River Campaign for the Union Army. Edward and the 23rd Wisconsin did not arrive at Mansfield until the retreat. They did not fight there, but they marched the ground. I walked the battlefield reading the signs and the markers, the small plaques and the larger memorials, the way you do when a place has been preserved and you have come a long way to read what is there. I read the order of battle. I read the casualties. I read the names of the regiments that lost more than half of all Union dead on that field in a single afternoon. I tried to find the place Edward's regiment would have passed through on its way north a few weeks later. It rained the entire day. At one point, I thought about going back to my hotel room and waiting it out. There was no one to know whether I quit. The signs would still be there tomorrow. And then it occurred to me that the man I had come to find did not have that option. I walked in the rain and did not complain. What was lost? I should say plainly, the letters and the uniform did not survive intact into the present day in the way you might want to imagine they did. The originals dispersed. The uniform, which I remember being held against me in December of 1975 in my grandparents' kitchen, has gone. I have lost contact with where it is. It survives in this book only as a memory. A 10-year-old boy standing in a farm kitchen with cold hay dust still in his hair, and a faded blue jacket held up against his shoulders, and a woman holding it who knew the man had been her grandmother's father but could not have told you much more than that. The uniform may still be in someone's attic. It may have gone to the dump in 1987. I don't know. What survives here in this book is what was in the letters. And what survives in the broader Bennett family is a fact most of my relatives know in the abstract but cannot quite locate on the family tree. An ancestor wrote letters during the Civil War. The letters exist. The exact line of descent that connects each of us to that ancestor is for many of my cousins and second cousins blurry. This book is one small attempt to bring those things back into focus. The decision. I have always been interested in world history. I'm certain that the discovery of those letters when I was 10 had something to do with it. They made the subjects I was studying in school come alive and personal. The Civil War was not only a chapter in a textbook, it was something a man in my family had walked through. A few years ago, when artificial intelligence began to move from a curiosity into a tool, one of the first things I thought of was those 4 pages. My hope was simple. I wanted, after all this time, an accurate transcription. The original handwriting had defeated me for 50 years. I wanted to finally read what the letter said. I sent the 4 pages through Anthropic's Claude chatbot. Claude returned a transcription in under 30 seconds. For the first time in over 50 years, I was reading the letter word for word. The script I had been losing my whole life became sentences. The sentences became a voice. The voice belonged to a man writing to his wife on a specific April morning in New Orleans, expecting to march toward the Red River, worried about her and the children, signing himself off with affection that has not aged. I sat with that for a long time. And then something I had not expected happened. Claude asked me a question. Would you like to research who Robert was? My first thought was, who's Robert? I had read past the name without registering it. But Claude had caught something I had not. Robert appeared in the letter not as a soldier alongside Edward in some incidental way, but as someone closer in. The grammar around the name carried weight a stranger's name does not carry. Yes, I said, I wanted to know who Robert was. Claude turned to the work, and within minutes I learned that Robert was Robert Walker Hume Sr., the brother of Edward's wife Janet, and that he had served in the same Wisconsin unit as Edward. The man Edward was asking after across the page was his brother-in-law. The two men had marched into the war together. They were not soldiers who happened to know each other. They were family who had enlisted together and were keeping each other alive on a Louisiana river, and Edward was writing home to ask his wife whether her own brother's family was holding up. A letter I had stared at for 50 years had opened in 5 minutes into a story I had not known was there. That was the moment. I realized that a transcription was the smallest thing I had been asking for. I wanted to know Edward. I wanted to know what he saw, what he felt, who the people in the letters actually were, what it meant to march toward the Red River in April of 1864 instead of staying in Wisconsin where his wife and her brother's children and Edward's own 5 children were all waiting. A war is not a small event in any history. It is not a small event in this one. I needed to know why. What this book is, then, is an attempt to use the tools that exist now to do what 10-year-old me could not do with the original handwriting, what teenage me could not do with the photocopies, what adult me could not do alone with 4 scanned pages, to bring Edward Bennett back into the room and let him tell, as best as documentation and method allow, what he did during those 2 years and what he came home with. He kept a diary during those years. He kept records of every mile he traveled. 800 by railroad, 5,200 by steamboat, 800 more on foot. He came home, and he taught school, and he served as an assessor, and he superintended a Sunday school, and he lived to be 90. At 70, he sat down and rewrote his entire war diary in a clean hand and had a daughter bind it for him. He cared about being remembered correctly. I want to connect Edward to the people of today. Not only my own family, many of whom know the letters exist but cannot quite place themselves on the line of descent, but anyone who picks up this book. If history can be given its voice back, maybe it can keep history from repeating. That is not a small claim, I know it, but I do not think it is a wrong one. My reason for using artificial intelligence to bring Edward Bennett back to speak is so that he might share whatever wisdom a 90-year-old man would have carried with him across a century. With modern-day readers who, like all of us, spend our lives searching for whys. So please allow me to take some journalistic latitude. Please allow Edward Bennett to speak again.